Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Simon Phipps joins me. We're going to be talking about Berrios, a great way to back up your system no matter what platform it is. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps. Episode 531, recorded May 22nd, 2019. Berrios. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stoners.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you may want to download right after the show and play with. I bet today is going to be one of those. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Simon Phipps. Simon, welcome back to the show.
Well, good afternoon, Randall. It's a pleasure to see you. And I'm sorry to hear that you're lacking sleep where you are. Here in England, I've been working all day. The sky is blue. The sun is out. It's actually quite nice out.
Awesome, awesome. And I am once again, as we like to call it, the Tijuana kitchen set. And once again, just like last week, I will point out that there is one magnet that has been moved. So I'm not pointing at it. Somewhere on that refrigerator, there's one magnet that's been moved from all the months I've been doing the show here. So if you are the first to tweet this, which magnet actually has been moved, you get absolutely nothing except for the ability to say I tweeted that which magnet was moved. Anyway, so today we have an interesting show, like we almost always do, and I kind of mispronounce this already, Berrios Backup. And it was actually a fork of Bacula Backup, which apparently, according to the FAQ I just read, went closed source after a while, but the license it was formerly under allowed them to fork it, allowed our guest today, Mike Ossendorf, is going to be talking to us today about how he forked Bacula and what he's been doing with it since. So that's kind of the gist of the show. It's a backup solution. I haven't read much about it because that's kind of how I roll, is trying to figure out how to just talk about things here on the show without actually knowing anything about that. What do you know about this so far, Simon?
I know exactly what's in my briefing notes, which is not a huge amount. I do remember the name Bacula, and it always made me think of vampires whenever I heard it. We've already clarified, I think, that this is called Berrios and not Berrios, so we don't have to talk about nakedness. So apart from that, you know, that's all of my clues, and I'm hoping to gather some from Mike when we get to talk to him.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, without further ado, let's go ahead and bring on Mike Ossendorf. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, good afternoon or good evening from Germany.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm based in Cologne, Germany.
Cologne, I think I've been there once. No, is that near the Rhine?
Yes, the Rhine goes through the city and the big cathedral here.
Yes, I rode a riverboat once, a river cruise, up the Rhine from the north end down to the south end, I guess. I guess that would be the other direction. Right, yeah, that direction. That was wonderful. I love river cruises. It's amazing, especially when you realize that they actually have to lower the wheelhouse on the ship to be able to go under some of the docks, because the gates of the, it's not dock, what is that? I've completely forgotten. Okay, well, let's stop with that. Let's start with a lot more useful things. Tell us, when you're reaching for Berrios, what problem are you trying to solve?
Oh, we are solving the problem of data sovereignty and data security. So if you lose your data on your backup, on your disk, for example, then nowadays a lot of your personal stuff like photos might get lost, or if you're talking about a company or organization, a lot of vital data that makes the asset today of companies might get lost. So what you have to have or should have is a backup of your data, and that is what we are doing. With Berrios, we can back up from several kind of operating systems, Linux, of course, Windows, Unix systems, and have a schedule that plans when to do backups, from which data, from which computer, and where to write it. And then, of course, if you have a problem and you want back some files of whatever version you have in your backup, you can go to the database using a nice web UI, search for files that you might have lost, and then restored. So that's the idea of backup and recovery.
So is this a backup that's happening to a local device that you are attaching to your machine, or is this a backup that's going up into the cloud somewhere?
Oh, there are many options. So most people have their own backup server. So that's usually a Linux server running somewhere in the organization. And they collect data from all the systems in their network and write it on disk of that or any other server. You can also attach tape drives, tape libraries, if you're a bigger organization. And you also have the option to write a backup to several cloud providers. And then, of course, you should take care that it's encrypted.
So you mentioned tape. I haven't seen tape in years. Do people still actually use that?
Yes, definitely. Well, not for home users or for small organizations. But so here in Europe, you have to keep financial relevant data for at least 10 years if you're a company. And if you have a lot of those data, and for 10 years, it's almost the most economy solution. So it's the cheapest solution for long-term storage because you don't have the disk drives to spin all the time. So you save a lot of energy. And if you talk about even longer periods, it's more reliable. So the probability that a bit flips on a disk is much higher than on a tape.
So when we're talking about a backup, we're talking about like just a clone of what's on your internal drives, or are you talking about having some sort of versions of your backups?
Right. So the normal way of doing backups is that you make regular full backups. That means a full copy of your files on your disk or VMware or virtual machine images or database dumps or whatever. And then you write it to a certain place. And then most people do daily incremental, so not always store the full set of data, but only things that have changed compared to the last date when you made your backup. So, and then you end up with a lot of files on your backup space. And what's a crucial point is to get the right file back. So you can use the user interface of Bareos, and then you browse through the catalog, and you see, for example, if you look for a certain Word document and you have changed it maybe last week and you need the version from the day before, then you can exactly take that version back to your computer.
So are these backups like the whole file that's changed, or do you have some way of doing like an incremental on the incremental?
The incremental is done on a whole file, so not just on blocks. We're doing incremental on incrementals, if you want to use that wording, when we back up VMware snapshots. So we have a dedicated plugin for VMware that makes a snapshot and then uses the changed block tracking method to get only the changed blocks. So that would be then an incremental of the VMware image.
Okay. And I understand from reading the documentation, in the FAQ at least, that this was a fork of a project that went closed source. Can you talk to us about that?
Actually, it's not precise to say it went closed source. A couple of years ago, Bacula split up into two versions. One is what they call Bacula Enterprise, and that is under a proprietary license, but they still have and maintain what they call Community Edition, and that's still under AGPL. But what happened at the time when we decided to make the fork, that was at the end of 2012, that mostly new features went into the proprietary closed source enterprise version. And we had a lot of experiences from a lot of projects where we implemented Bacula, and we were also working with the development. So one of the core Bacula developer also wanted to make sure that there is an open source backup solution. And so we decided to make a fork of the Bacula Community Edition at that time and continue to develop it and make sure that it really stays open.
So your code here is under AGPL as well, and all of the improvements you've made are under AGPL too, are they?
Yes, absolutely. So we can't change the license, and we don't want to change it, and we think AGPL is exactly the right license, because people start to offer web services based on Bareos. And if you want to avoid vendor lock-ins or service provider lock-ins, you really should take care that you have access to the source code of the backup solution in the end. So we will stick to and are committed to open source.
Right. So I noticed that you have a company with the same name that presumably owns the trademark to that name. So what is your business model in doing this work?
Yeah, right. The company owns the trademark. That's true. And the business model is really similar to what Red Hat or Nextcloud or others do. So we keep the source code completely open. Everything we do is published on GitHub by means of the source code. But we also provide binary packages or repositories for almost every current Linux distribution, also for Windows and BSD and others. And we do this more or less once a year whenever we have a new major release. The binary package installer repositories are there and updated. But then within the year when we do maintenance updates, security patches, stuff like that, we still publish the source code on GitHub. But the binary packages that we build and test very intensively and certify, they are available only for our subscription customers. So that's the base of the business model, very similar to Red Hat Enterprise Linux. And of course, there are several support options on top of that, which are also part of the business model.
Right. So do you provide any binaries to people to just download off your website, or are those only available if I pay?
No, we provide binaries for every new major release. So the current release is 18.2, which we published at the beginning of this year. And those binaries are available. But for updates we did in the meantime, the binaries are only available for subscription customers. But every year...
Is that even if there's a CVE?
Yes.
So if I start using Barrios for my backups and there's a malicious exploit that is anchored in a CVE, I won't get the fix for that without paying you money.
You have two options. If you don't want to pay the money or don't want to buy a subscription, you can compile the source code. And we also, I haven't said that before, we do development in two branches. So in the what we call master branch, where it's the current bleeding edge technology, and the major release or stable release that we maintain. And usually if there are very important bugs, they will be fixed on both branches. So of course for the subscription customers, but also on the master branch. Maybe not that fast, but it will get fixed there. And we also publish from time to time binary packages for the master branch, which we don't recommend to use for production because it's bleeding edge technology, but bugs are also fixed there, and then people can use it there and test it. Or still have the other option to compile the software, and that's what open source about. It's free open source, meaning that the code is available, but not open binary.
Right. When you say community, I'm just having a look at your GitHub repository here. When you say community, what do you mean? Some people, when they say community, just mean their users. Other people, when they say community, mean peers who are collaborating with them. Which do you mean by community?
All of this. So we have a community, for sure, of many users, and you also can get help from them on our mailing list, for instance. But we also have a community of contributors. So, for example, we have about translations of our web UI. I think it's 10 or 12 languages, and most of the translation came from the community. We also have a Python plugin interface. That was one of the first things we've implemented after the fork. And there are plugins coming in. So, for example, there is a libcloud plugin, which enables user to back up data from S3 instances, for example, for S3 storage or other cloud providers. And that came in from the community. So there's many stuff coming in. And there, of course, the community is also people answering questions on the mailing list or mentioning us on Twitter or writing case studies or stuff like that. So,
right. So why aren't any of those people making binaries available?
I'm sorry, didn't get that.
So if there is a community of people who are not just your customers, yes. Why aren't any of them making binaries available?
Oh, good question. So I don't know. So maybe, or I guess most of them are happy with the solution that there is. We also must say we haven't seen a lot of really critical bugs in the major version. So a lot of people are happy with the major version, install it once a year and are fine. And those who need, for policy reason or for other reasons, official certified binaries, say, then go and buy a subscription and support.
Right. And so this is available on which architectures? It's obviously available on Linux. What else is it available on?
It's for most current Linux distributions, for Windows, FreeBSD. We also have macOS clients. I'm not sure if you have the latest release from macOS. And we have some clients available for Solaris AIX, HPUX, for example.
Right. And so are your backups portable between those different architectures? Or do they only work on a single architecture? I mean, if I was going to back up my data files, would I be able to restore them on a different architecture?
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. So that's no problem. You can restore the backups you've made on any Windows machine, for example, to any other Linux server or Linux laptop or whatever. So that makes no difference.
Right. So who is it that decides what your roadmap is going to be for your new releases? Do you have a community process for that, or is that something that you dictate?
Well, I wouldn't say dictate. We have regular developer meetings where most of them are part of the company as well. So there is no real strict community process, but of course we get feature requests that are discussed on the mailing list. We also have the possibility that users or more companies that require a certain feature can say, okay, we would like to have this feature and get it on top of the priority list and help developing it with funding. So there's a subsection on the website listing some projects where people already said they have a certain feature request and would take part of it, and if others would join that, that could help and speed up the development of a certain feature.
So you mentioned there that you've got some contributors who are not employees. What is the sort of ratio there? I'm just looking at your GitHub here, and it doesn't make me feel that there's a lot of independent contributors.
Yeah, most of the contributors are employed by the company. If you look to the, there's a contrib repository for plugins. There are some more externals, and we have also seen some contributions from, well, let's say external people, but mostly that are smaller portions or, as I said before, translation files, for example. So, to be honest, most of the, what we call, let's say, core development of the project is done by people from our company. That's true.
Right. So, given that you're, using your position of control of the project to drive business with customers, can you tell me what the difference is between you and Bacula?
Oh. I must admit, I haven't looked into what's happening at Bacula a lot over the last time. But one big distinction is that we don't require contribution license agreements. So CLAs is something that we don't want to have. But for example, if you want to contribute to Bacula, you have to sign the CLA. And then, it may happen that what you contributed as open source will also go into the proprietary product. So that will definitely not happen with Barrio. So every contribution is done under purely AGPL and nothing else.
Right. So presumably you don't really have a choice about that because you don't own the copyright. So there's no point getting contribution agreements, really. So.
Right. Yeah. That's true, absolutely, and we don't want it. We could do something for special parts, but we don't have the intention to do so. So it's true, there's no real choice, but we also don't want it. So.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking about, you know, who sets your roadmap. What is on your roadmap going into the future?
Yeah, we're actually doing a lot of internal rewrites because many structures are pretty old and the architecture is not documented very well. So that's maybe one reason why we don't see so many external contributors. It's really hard to get into the code. And we decided to make it much more modular, use modern C functions to make it easier for external to contribute. So that's, what's happening under the hood. What we are working on for the next release is one thing, big thing for large organizations that have big tape libraries, and you often have the problem that you have a lot of drives and you want to use these tape drives from several backup computers simultaneously. And on the SCSI protocol level, there's something that's called SCSI drive reservation. And we don't support it yet, but we will support it with a next version, and that makes it much easier to handle more tape drives in large environments. And very, well, technically similar to that is something that is useful for other users as well. Because if we now do backups to disk, we kind of simulate a tape drive. So there is a virtual tape drive writing data to disk that is some legacy stuff that we got. But if you think about if you think about disks and writing data there, it makes no sense to limit yourself. So what we're doing is we automatically configure these virtual drives so that an administrator, a Bareos administrator, has to care about this configuration stuff. He will just get as many virtual disks as he needs to do parallel backups.
Oh, sorry. I didn't realize my turn already. we just chatted in the chat room, but we didn't usually we chat back and forth about who's actually going to talk next. So that's why it's usually seamless, but it was not seamless this time. So what is this written in? Is this like C#, C++, C? All those things start with C.
Yeah.
What's it written in?
Good question. So the original Baculab project was started back in the 90s, and there was little C++ code. So it's basically C at that time, and then some modern structures came into, but not really designed as object-oriented. So you find some C++ structures in the legacy code, but now we are trying to get it more and more class and object-oriented. And getting into in more modern C and C++ features as well. Then we have the Python plugin interface that's good to do specific application backups, like I mentioned before, the VMware plugin. There's also a MySQL plugin written in Python that makes use of Percona Extra Backup, another open source project. And that's all done in Python and helps to make incremental backups of MySQL databases. So to make it short, C, C++, getting more and more to C++ and object-oriented architecture and Python plugin interfaces.
And how do you keep track of what's changed so you know whether an incremental backup should include something or not? Do you have like a database behind it somewhere?
Yes, right. So we have an SQL database. We support MySQL and Postgres. So for performance reasons, we recommend to use Postgres. And there we keep track of everything Bareos does. So whenever a file gets into the backup, we keep track of from which computer does it come, when was it backup, what was the checksum, the Unix or Windows permission, other file attributes, for example. So that's all in the what we call it, catalogs. That's a SQL database.
And you're able to browse that to see what files were backed up on what days?
Yes. So actually, with a web UI, you have a file browser. So you select a client that you're interested in, and then you get the file system hierarchy with subdirectories you can drill into and look. And then that's also some thing for the next WebUI version is that we will then have a version browser, so we can see what from which date this particular file is there. Right now, that can be done over the console. There's a text-based console interface, and there you can also dedicatedly search for a file and a certain date when it went into the backup. So.
And does it have a web interface as well?
Yes. So as I said, the web interface is available since a couple of years with 10 or even 12 languages supported. And there you have a little bit less features than in the text-based user interface. But we are heavily extending this. So you have both choices, a text-based user interface and a web UI.
And how do you test something like this? I mean, there's got to be a lot of edge cases, corner cases, things like that. And do you have any sense of like what your code coverage is in your tests?
Yes, we do. That was one of the first thing we did when we started with Bareos. We set up a continuous integration testing framework using Jenkins. And we still use Jenkins for that and more. And so the whole build process is completely automated. So starting from a Git commit, we use the Open Build Service, which was invented by SUSE some time ago to build the packages, also for Windows. That's completely automated. Then when the packages are built, we start Jenkins, and Jenkins will then start for every distribution, for every Linux distribution, also Windows, will start up virtual machines with exactly this distribution, will then use the repository to install the Bareos packages, do backup and restore jobs, and will finally deinstall the packages. And then we see that these basic functions work on every distribution. Additionally, we have a set of regression tests. It's a lot more than 100 regression tests that test certain features. But we don't do this for every distribution. This is done usually only once. But we are heavily extending this. So we switched with the last version to CMake and CTest. Which also enables us to write module tests for just certain parts of the code. So yes, we invest a lot of time in doing this and automating this to be able to really quickly make patches and releases available and also give developers the feedback. So for example, my colleague Philip is actually working on to do all this testing stuff on pull requests. So if someone from the community makes a pull request, we will do all this testing stuff before we decide if we accept the pull request or if there are problems, then we can get in contact with a contributor and tell him what the problems are, and then he can fix it. And then when we finally have tested everything inside this pull request, then we can accept it and merge it, and we know then, or we can be sure that it's really working.
There's a lot of people that have already solved the backup problem. I mean, I use probably four or five different kinds of things for backup from my laptop and things like that. I've got Backblaze, and I've got Carbon Copy Cloner, things like that. This seems like it's a solved problem. So what distinguishes Bareos from the others?
Yeah, you are right. The pure technical problems are solved by a lot of projects or products for a while. There are some technical points where we are kind of ahead, like backing up from and to the cloud with connectors to several technologies. But I think the most important point is still, I mean, we here, and I guess most of the visitors of the show love open source. And so we use it because we love the idea behind it of collaborating, building things together with the community. But it's especially if we talk about data, which is like the valuables or assets in our time, and data sovereignty, I think it's especially crucial to do backups with open source for a couple of reasons. So one is, of course, vendor lock-in, if you just think in short or midterms. There are products around that limit the usage of the software. So you need a license key or something to run the software. And then, of course, if you need a restore, you still need the license key or pay something to get to your data. I mean, imagine if we make an analogy to old analogous techniques. If you had like physical valuables and you would buy a new iron safe, for example, and the vendor would tell you, okay, here's your nice safe. You can keep it home and put your valuables inside, but I keep the key here. And whenever you need to access your valuables, you first have to come here to my shop and make sure that you pay your license fees, and then you get the key. So nobody would have bought such a safe. But in our days, a lot of people do the same with software, and that's really not theoretical. I had a customer that makes this experience, most of us don't read all the small printed text in contracts or user agreements, but a lot of solutions require that you delete your software when you stop paying the license. And then if you do this with backup software, for whatever reasons, maybe you run out of budget or whatever, and then you can't get access to your data, that might be the end for your company or for your organization. So, and that's just short term. And then especially if you think about long term, like 10, 20 or more years, for example, I had a discussion with Airbus a couple of years ago. They think in terms of 70 years. So from the first phase when they start planning an aircraft and until the last aircraft gets to the ground, it's 60 or 70 years. And they have to make sure that they keep all the data for this long time period. And that's why they have a dedicated open source strategy. And this, of course, is crucial when you talk about backups and want to access your data in 10 or 20 years. Even if we or another company or project has died, you still have the code and you have at least the possibility to get a developer to fix your code or to adapt it to new hardware. If you need new drivers to read the media, you have. And that's only possible with open source. And I think that's the big distinction. If we combine this pure open source solution with the support that we deliver. I mean, there are a lot of open source projects for backup, but then you don't get support for it. And on the other hand, there are a lot of enterprises with proprietary backup solutions and good support, but then you don't have open source. And we have both, so we are open source and we have professional support. And I really think that's a big difference.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because if I hadn't been a professional sysadmin for many, many decades, I want to say, no, probably at least years, I wouldn't be backing up every day. And I wonder if that's a sort of a like an on-ramping problem that you have trying to talk to your customers. I mean, I have these wonderful little drives. If you're watching the video, there are these little USB-C drives that are just wonderful. They're SSDs, so they go real quick. I have two of them. And I alternate every other day backing up. And I also reboot every time before I back up because I want to make sure I'm starting from a known solid place. But that's just because I'm disciplined about this, you know. And these drives get sent to, I got Backblaze, so I'm putting them in the sky every day too. But at home, I've got a Drobo. And I back up from the Drobo to another external drive. I tell you, I'm like crazy about backups. I really am crazy. How do you get people thinking, well, maybe not this crazy, but how do you get people thinking like this?
Well, it makes a big difference if you have a small home office. So, for example, I have a little network at home with a Linux server running around the clock, and I have a USB drive attached, and I write my Barrios backups there. So it's absolutely okay to write it to USB disks or so. But in larger organizations or companies, most of them, they do have regular backups. We see a lot of like self-made scripting solutions using Tara, Async or something. But at a certain point, if it's a company and then they have a manager or so that has technical knowledge, he will probably ask, how do we structure backups? How do we know that the backup worked? Are there checks to verify? How do you monitor it? And when it comes to such a point, then a lot of people look for like a broader approach with Bareos or general backup tools.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that's about these drives here that I'm carrying with me all the time is that they're bootable, which means that if for some reason my internal drive, knock on wood, my internal drive goes bad, I can at least boot off of these things, and I have at most a one-day behind view of, yeah. of my world. Can you clone with Bareos? Can you make it a bootable clone?
Not with Bareos alone, but we work together with another open source project that is called RIR. The acronym stands for Relax and Recover. And that project does what we call bare metal recovery or disaster recovery. So in short words, it's a collection of shell scripts. And if you make what you call a clone of a computer or a Linux machine, you run this scripts and RIR will create a bootable ISO image for you. So you can burn it on CD or USB stick or whatever. And then if you want to recover your computer because something badly happened to it, you will boot from this RIR medium. And RIR will take care that the basic system layout gets recovered, like file systems, kernel, DRBD devices, logical volume manager, and things on the very system level. And then it will start the Bareos client and bring back the user data from the Bareos server. And that is a very efficient solution because you don't need a full clone to restore your machine. You just need the ISO image to get the basic system layout back. And then you have your backups on a hopefully daily basis, so you get back the state from the day before, but without having to do full backups every day. So that's a very efficient solution, and we are happy that we work together with guys from the RIR project. You will find packages on our repository as well, or at least links. I think we've changed it, and now we use the packages that the RIR project provides. But it's all well documented. There are a lot of conference papers and demonstrations of the combination of RIA and Bareos.
So now just to change track a little here, Mike, GDPR has come upon us here in Europe, suddenly we have a whole load of new data protection responsibilities. One of the nightmares that I have as a business owner is that I have to keep my data for 7 or 10 years or more, but not all of it. Some of it I have to be able to delete all traces and all backups of data if a customer writes to me and tells me that they no longer give their consent to me retaining it. Are you building any solutions for people like me who want to keep comprehensive backups but also don't want to pay large percentages of my turnover as fines for keeping customer data after they've asked not to keep it?
Yeah, that's a technically interesting question. We have an idea to solve it, and partly we can solve it just with configuration measures. So to be short, the trick is that we have copy jobs. That means we can say, here's a backup job and copy it to another medium plus the what we call catalogs, a database where we keep track of all the files that are in the backup. And if you do a backup job, only those, if you do a copy job, that means you copy the backup data to another medium, only those data is considered that is referenced in the catalog. So, and here comes the trick. If you now have to delete some files also from the backup, because a customer demands it, so you have to do two things. You have to find the file in the catalog, delete the information about these file there, and then copy the physical medium to another using a copy job. So then the information will be definitely lost. Maybe the first step could be sufficient, because without database information about the file, it's possible but difficult to restore. So, but if you want to be on the safe side, then you would have to do both steps.
Mm-hmm. And if I'm maintaining multiple backup destinations, so I'm doing cloud backups, is that approach going to work for my backup that I have with a cloud provider, as well as a backup that I have in my local storage.
You mean the approach to delete information you keep? Yeah, it's technically possible, but of course then you would have to make copy jobs for all of these backups you have. Also on the cloud, possible, but not a thing that you would probably like to do.
Yes. So, I mean, it strikes me that the GDPR was written by people who had never heard of computers before and yet feared them.
sometimes I think so. Well, so the basic idea behind the GDPR is definitely good to make people and organizations think about how they keep the data. But if it comes to technical solutions, it sometimes gets the impression that you are right. Yes.
Right. And a similar problem arises if you're dealing with copyrighted materials. Now, I noticed that in your project news, you are talking about the copyright directive letter. How did you feel about the new European Copyright Directive? Because, you know, running a business that's keeping copies of things, it must have looked very worrying to you.
Well, it doesn't look worrying to our business model because we are not a service provider. So we just provide the software for other people to providing services. I think it's not really the problem also for service providers that offer backup as a service, but it's a problem for a lot of smaller projects and companies that offer web services where people can upload stuff. So and these are often our users or customers or both, if you want to put it that way. So for them, it's a big problem, and especially for smaller companies on offering such innovative services, for them, it's a big problem. For me or for our company in person, it's not that problematic.
Right. Well, but I mean, presumably, as this wave of badly thought through legislation comes through both in Europe, and I'm anticipating it will come through in America as well. Presumably, you're going to have to start architecting backup solutions that allow people to do their impossible compliance tasks. And so that is a burden on you.
Well, maybe I don't see it really yet because backup is usually only available for the administrator running the backup, and the copyright directive is more about data that is made available to the public. So let's say if an administrator or organization runs whatever kind of web services where people can upload stuff, and he will of course then do a backup, and then for some legal requirement he might have to remove the content from the platform he provides to the public, then he will delete it there. But I guess nobody will care about that it's still in the backup. So I don't see a big problem here. And even if the requirement would go into that direction, we would be able to find a solution as outlined before. It would be more or less the same as customers requiring you to delete the data from your backup. So there could be a solution. But of course, for all the administrators and companies running web-based services, it's a nightmare.
Yeah. So is your organization part of any of the European civil society networks? Do you support FSFE or Open Forum Europe or any of the other organizations that are trying to stop any of this idiocy going any further?
Well, we are we have another company that provides services around open source projects, and with that company we are a member of the OSBA, that's the Open Source Business Alliance here in Germany. With Barreos, we support a smaller organization here in Bonn, our neighbor city. They take care about technical IT education for young people who are interested in open source. But we are not member of any other associations.
So we're almost out of time, but I did want to cover a couple more topics before we let you go. is the layout of the backup published? I mean, can I write independent software that would actually be able to read that?
You mean to read the data that we write to disk as backup images, right?
Yes.
Yes, that is at least documented in the source code. And there is some...
okay.
There is some start. There's a developer guide or developer documentation. But I must say, I'm not sure if all the bits and pieces are really documented step by step. But there are a set of command line tools to extract the data. So, for example, if you have a total crash of everything and just have the tapes or backup images, you can use some command line tools that you can easily compile to extract the data from the media. So you don't need a running Bareos server to access your backup data. You can do it with a set of simple command line tools, and then that would help you to restore, possibly at first, the server to make your life easier, and then other stuff.
And is this your full-time gig now?
Full-time? Yes, for me it's a full-time job, right, yeah.
And what were you doing before this that had you then become interested in backups all of a sudden?
What I did before, you mean? I studied mathematics and computer science, working on artificial intelligence, but at that time, 20 years ago, there was no big demand on the market. And then I went shortly to South America to work at Siemens and an SAP project. Found that after a while quite boring. Came back to Germany and joined at SUSE at that time, 99, which was a very exciting time because a lot of larger organizations and companies started to think about using Linux and open source, and we as consultants were always part of it. And then we founded an IT or open source service company in 2004 and did a lot of projects with SUSE, Red Hat, Bacula, and other open source stuff. Very exciting time, yes.
So AI, you were like 20 years ahead of your time. That's the problem.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but
now
that was
huge. It's huge now.
It's huge. Yeah, at that time it was kind of fundamental research, trying things to model, make models of neural networks, and do some basic tests. But computing power was that slow at that time. That's also the nets were really slow and small. So at that time we could imagine what happened some years later. But today it's really amazing to see what the options are that have evolved over the last 20 years.
Now, we've actually had some discussion in the chat room about whether this will make it easier for governments to get a hold of data. Do you ever have that worry late at night?
You mean that governments get access to data?
Yeah.
I didn't get that right.
Because you're if you are backing stuff up, then governments can subpoena that and take it. I'm not asking if they can get to it even without you knowing about it. I'm asking about just that you've been backing stuff up, but maybe you never think about that.
Yes, so I'm happy to live in a state that's a pretty stable democracy, but even here we have secret agencies doing evil stuff. So I always take care that we encrypt our data. So and that's we haven't talked about that before. So we have several ways to encrypt data before we backup or when we transport it. But of course, if you make backups to cloud providers, that really should be strongly encrypted. And if I think about like non-governmental organizations that store a lot of critical information in their backup, then that makes it easier for, let's say, the bad guys to access it. That's true.
Yeah.
Every redundancy makes it easier to access data, and that's true for everybody. So for the legitimate user as well as for others.
And good for you for living in a country that's relatively stable. I have my doubts these days. I should not bring politics into this show ever. Why do I keep doing that? All right. Anyway, we're almost out of time. Two more questions. Three more questions. Is there anything we didn't talk about that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we have to let you go?
Yeah, one thing is we didn't say when I talked about the thing we were working on the current release, that if you today use Bareus with the latest available stable version, you get encryption pre-configured. So the transport encryption between all components is pre-configured without the hassle to create and maintain certificates.
Okay, and one other question actually came from the chat room. When are you going to incorporate blockchain into this?
Well, I'm thinking since we started, I said we talked about earlier about artificial intelligence, and I'm always thinking, couldn't I use a neural network at some place, make it more interesting, and it sounds sexy, but until now I haven't found a good use case for using either artificial intelligence or blockchain. I'm sorry, so if anybody has a good idea, I would love to do that, but there's nothing that I found that brings us forward.
It's part of the drinking game for this show. The moment I mention blockchain, somebody gets to drink. So that's kind of how this works. Anyway, and two more final questions. One is, what's your favorite programming language?
Python.
Python, okay. And what's your favorite text editor?
My favorite text editor, well, the one I use at most is VI.
VI. Honestly, I can't win on either of those, I guess.
I keep it used to be Emacs, but that's 20 years ago. Yeah, that's Emacs. I had Emacs, but 20 years ago, yeah.
All right. Well, at least you at one point used a reasonable text editor, because I know Emacs can emulate VI and it's not the other way around. So, yeah. Okay. Hey, it's been wonderful having you on the show, Mike, talking about Bareus. There we go. You would think you'd said it enough times that I would have heard it by now. Anyway, and thank you for talking about this. I'll look into it a little bit more, and we'll see how that goes. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for joining us. Thank you.
Awesome. That was Mike Esseldorf talking about Bareus. What do you think there, Simon?
Well, it sounds a fairly comprehensive system, even without an AI-based IoT blockchain solution built into it.
yes.
The only thing that that really concerned me was the idea that they would not make available fixes to people if there was a severe CVE, an exploitable CVE reported. That made me feel very uncomfortable as a matter of policy. That the point when people are having a security crisis is maybe a good time to exploit them for money, but it isn't a seemly thing to do. Apart from that, it sounds like it's a very comprehensive, well thought through, and mature system, which you would expect from having forked something that was already mature and capable, and then further developed it. So I would probably put it on my list to evaluate if I was looking for a backup solution. What do you think, Randall? Well, you've used this stuff before.
And to his credit, I will say that given that it's sitting on GitHub right now, and if there was any fixes that needed to be made in response to a CVE, I bet those would be on the repository really quick. So I imagine if I don't mind compiling something, that your challenge is minimal. I see that you'd want someone to provide the binaries for you, but I don't think you would need that necessarily. Although, packaging solutions are a little bit crazy sometimes. It's kind of like you kind of want to be able to just go apt-get install, blah, 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 for
absolutely
something, right?
Yeah, particularly as there is somebody with a black hat in Russia trying to get into your backup system. That's the point at which you wish to simply tell the package manager to put the new version in and cut them off.
Yes, that would be good. Yeah, no, but great project. Sounds fun. Glad he contacted us. I think, I love it when shows like this sort of show up in my queue to all I have to worry about is scheduling and getting it on the slot somewhere. And that's always nice. And speaking of that, we do have upcoming shows and a new one added since last week. So let's go ahead and go through the rundown here. Next week, is the IBM Cloud Platform. So it's a full-stack cloud platform that spans public, private, and hybrid environments. I believe it's like the VP of the IBM Cloud Platform. I met him, I believe, at Cloud Foundry. So you're going to talk a little bit about what Cloud Foundry allows us to do in terms of migrating our code and data across things, you know, and I'm sure he's going to mention at least once or twice that IBM does, in fact, have a commercial service that does this. But we'll let him do that.
That seems implausible to me. I can't imagine that even being mentioned. Yeah.
But we'll let him mention that in exchange for also describing what the heck Cloud Foundry is, because that's actually a consortium of something like 20 different companies that have come together and made basically the same platform everywhere, so you can migrate your data and code across everything. So that's going to be fun. CryptPad is a private by design alternative to popular office tools and cloud services, and everything's encrypted. They don't even have the key. Redis is going to come back in. They were back on the show in July of 2017, but they said they've changed a lot of stuff since then. Oh, you're going to talk about that. You should be on for that license discussion on this show.
Yeah, I didn't know that I'm around that week, but that's a week when you need somebody to ask some questions about what on earth they thought they were doing with the Commons Clause license, an ill-judged travesty is the polite
way of describing
it. Let's
not scare them from being on the show. They're going to come on the show. We're going to talk about what Redis has changed in the last couple of years, including their license. All right. OPSI is an open-source client management system to manage heterogeneous environments, and it enables the deployment and configuration from OSs and software on Windows and Linux computers. That'll be fun. And for those of you that have been demanding another blockchain show. We have CX coming up after that. It's a general purpose interpreted and compiled programming language with a very strict typing system and a syntax similar to Golang, which is Google's language. CX provides a new programming paradigm based on the concept of affordances, and it's primarily because it's about dealing with compiling down to Ethereum's code base, whatever it is, that you can build blockchain contracts and things in. So this is mostly targeted for that. But so yes, blockchain, we've got blockchain coming back for those of you that need to have two more drinks. There we go. Just added to the show, Micronaut, which is a modern JVM-based full-stack framework for building modular, easily testable microservice and serverless applications. That'll be fun too. So go to the homepage for the show, twitch.tv/floss, and you can see all the upcoming shows that we have and the actual schedule of all the ones I just mentioned. And you can also see the ones I'm still working on as well. We've got a few more on the slots, but nothing confirmed yet. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live@twit.tv. We took a few questions from there this time. Follow us at Floss Weekly on Twitter. And soon it'll be a Medium page. It'll have that medium.com. I have not gotten around to set that up yet. I've been lax in my duties sometimes. If you follow me at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N on Twitter. I'm going to be at the Pro Conference in Pittsburgh in mid-June. I'm going to be at OSCON in mid-July in Portland, which is going to be an easy trip for me. I'm going to be at All Things Open in Raleigh, North Carolina, Research Triangle there near Red Hat in mid-October. That's the only things I have scheduled right now. I've got like a cruise like next year, but nothing on soon before that. Anything you want to plug there, Simon?
Well, I'm going to be speaking at OW2Con in Paris on the 12th and 13th of June on behalf of the Document Foundation. And in particular, we've got a two-hour session on the 12th of June where we'll be explaining how you can use LibreOffice Online within an online solution, either yourself or within a commercial solution. That'll be really the first time we've run that workshop. And if you are anywhere near Paris, it will probably be worth coming along and joining us. I don't think I'm going to make it to OSCON this year unless something remarkable happens. So the next conference that I will be going to where people can discover me will be the LibreOffice conference, which is in Almeria in Spain, on the 11th to the 13th of September. And we would really love to see any users or would-be users of LibreOffice or LibreOffice Online at that conference. I was very pleased last time I was on to have some new subscribers to my Patreon. And if you would like to see me continue to eat and keep the lights on, I would very much welcome your contributions on patreon.com/webmink. I think that's everything.
Awesome, awesome. I almost thought you were going to say in space rather than in Spain, but that's just because I'm tired. That's how I heard it in my head. I was like, come on, I can't be in space. That'd be ridiculous. I'm going to go take a nap right after the show. And thank you, Simon, for once again being my wonderful and talented co-host.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you, Randall. I hope you get to sleep really well and that you're bright and fresh, ready for your new day, which presumably if you've not slept now and are going to bed, your new day must start at like 7 at night for you down there.
I have no idea what's happening today, actually. I'm just I know that I'm going to be closing my laptop at some point here. I've already done my backups. I'm okay with that. That's my clone happens every
day.
Very
important to remember your backups. Very important.
Always do my backups. All right. Well, we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.